I'll always remember this one Thanksgiving. I'm at my parents' house. It's a big family meal. You can picture it. There's kids running around. You know, I've loaded my plate. I have gravy, mashed potatoes, stuffing. It's a whole thing. So I sit down. I have my napkin across my lap. I'm talking to my friends and family, and my phone rings. I look down, and I see a familiar number. It's probably not a number that's familiar to everybody, but I recognize it as the California Department of Corrections. I have a call from an inmate. I glance at my plate and then at my family, who are already giving me the "don't you dare take this" look. They stare at me and I explain. It's Charles Manson.
You have a prepaid call from
Charles,
an inmate at the California State Prison, Corcoran, California. This call and your telephone number will be
monitored. I don't wait for the reaction. I step out of the room. The phone's to my ear.
Oh, hello.
His voice comes through scratchy and confident.
Hey, it's a good day, man. How are you doing?
Hanging on.
I'm James Buddy Day. This is Unmarked. When a person becomes a synonym for evil, they stop being real. They become a monster, something you can't stop talking about and you can't look away from. This is something that's just fascinated me my whole career. And I think it's why I was drawn to Charles Manson's story. 50 years later, we're still talking about the Manson family murders, still making TV shows, documentaries, writing books, even making podcasts. Maybe that says as much about him as it does about us.
I got your letters.
For me, it started with a letter that I sent him. I told Manson that I was a documentary filmmaker. I gave him my real phone number, and I never thought he'd call. Never in a million years. One evening, my phone rang. I still remember the first time Manson called me. I was at an Applebee's in Florida, eating chicken wings. Monday Night Football is blaring on the TV. My phone rings. I recognize the number almost instantly. I can see it's from the Department of Corrections in California, and I just bolted outside to answer, and the waitress literally ran to the door trying to flag us down.
You being a producer, it's like you kind of got to get in the heads of everybody.
The audio that you're hearing comes directly from the original prison phone recordings. It's raw and at times distorted, but it's exactly how it sounded when I first heard it. The transcript is available on our YouTube channel. I remember when I heard his voice that first time. You know, he has that characteristic Tennessee drawl. I thought that'd probably be the only time he would talk to me. I thought, hey, this is going to be a cool story to tell at parties or something like that. But he called me back the next day and the next day after that. And then we kept talking for the whole final year of his life. He died on November 19th, 2017, on a Sunday evening from cancer. You know, sometimes when he called me, I'd feel dread, I'd feel scared, I'd feel excited. I had this range of emotions. But at the end of the day, I mean, I'm a journalist. I wanted to hear his story in his own words. I remember telling him this, and his response was blunt.
I don't give a fuck about telling my story. My story has all really been all over the world. A thousand times. I'm interested in the results. What can you do? Can you get me a cell phone between you and I to where we can communicate?
Manson asked me to get him a cell phone more than once. Now, why he thought I could get him illegal contraband, I don't know. I still don't know to this day. But I always played along because I wanted to keep him talking. And what followed was years of me getting to meet his friends, his supporters, his former cellmates, and the surviving members of his so-called family. It was the women that really fascinated me. I wanted to sit across from them, to talk to them, to hear from them in their own words what happened. These people who are in the room when everything happened. I wanted the truth from them. And I feel looking back on it 10 years later, that I did get the truth. I feel that I know what happened, in as close as any journalist can. The best place to begin the story is in 1967. Charles Manson is 32 years old, and he's finishing a federal sentence for check fraud at Terminal Island Prison in the Port of Los Angeles. On March 21st, he walks out of the gates, and this is the last time Manson will ever be a free man. In fact, he told me about this. He said, when you walk out of prison, they call it a run.
When I get out of prison, I run. So I'm back in prison again.
Manson's view of the world was completely skewed. He saw prison as his home. That's where things made sense. But in 1967, he isn't the wild-eyed, bearded cult leader that you picture when you hear the name. Not yet. There's no cult. There's no followers. It's just a drifter named Charlie. He's wandering Los Angeles. He's got no money, no prospects, clean-shaven. He has that kind of aw shucks grin, that southern drawl. He grew up in Kentucky and West Virginia. And at that time, he's been arrested more than 30 times, mostly for moving stolen cars across state lines.
Then I've lived quite a life in the underworld.
A bit of forgery, some petty theft, two failed marriages, and two children he's lost contact with. But when Manson walks out of prison, he sees the world has changed. And this is something people really don't understand about Manson, because in 1967, the Vietnam War is dominating the headlines. Most men his age are fighting overseas or they're hiding out in college. So the women that he's finding are exploring freedom. They're exploring sex and music and rebellion. And they're laying the seeds for what will become the Summer of Love. So for the first time in his life, Manson fits in. You see, when Manson goes to prison in the 50s, he's a long-haired drifter. He's mocked by the clean-cut, square-jawed ideal of the time. But when he gets out in the 60s, the world has completely changed. Suddenly his long hair, his defiance, those counterculture views, they just fit. So he drifts between Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco and Topanga Canyon in Los Angeles, chasing the counterculture wave that's sweeping the country. And this is where he meets the women who will become the Manson family.
My family are righteous. They can't get away. They're dead. Every one of my family is dead like me.
So the Manson family, in the beginning at least, is really Manson and three women. The first is Mary Bruner, a librarian he meets in San Francisco, who they call Mother Mary or Mary.
Mary's a hell of a woman, man.
Then he meets a runaway named Patricia Krenwinkle near Venice Beach. She adopts the name Katie. And finally, he stumbles upon a red-haired teenager named Lynette Fromm while on Venice Beach. Lynette is literally contemplating killing herself when Manson just randomly walks up. They form this instant bond, and she becomes one of his most ardent supporters, later taking the name Squeaky. About those nicknames, everyone gets one. Squeaky, Sadie, Lulu, Gypsy, Darling. On the surface, it's symbolic. It's like shaving a soldier's head when he joins the army. It's a way to shed your past and become something new. And for the rest of 1967, well into 1968, this small group, they just drift through California, hitchhiking, squatting, singing for food. The women get pregnant. Squeaky and Katie miscarry. Mary gives birth to Manson's child in the back of a school bus they've commandeered.
Mary's she's a tremendous girl, man. Deliver her own baby.
And over time, the commune just grows. Word spread. More lost kids find their way to Charlie. And within a year, they're living at Dennis Wilson's house, one of the founding members of the Beach Boys. This is always such a bizarre aspect of the Manson family, that they crash with the Beach Boys for a significant period of time. Wilson simply becomes enamored with Charlie after a chance encounter with some of the women. The Beach Boys even go so far as to record one of Manson's songs. But after a few months, the family wears thin. They trash part of Dennis Wilson's mansion. They wreck his car. He ends up paying a small fortune for groceries and penicillin. and he kicks him out. This is a year before the murders, a year before the world will know their names. And they all relocate to a place called Spawn Ranch, a forgotten movie set on the edge of Los Angeles.
Everybody at the ranch was one.
And it's here that the transformation begins. In less than 12 months, this group will go from a nameless commune to a cult that terrorizes the city and shocks the world. But right now, no one's watching. I've met many people who lived at Spawn Ranch that summer, and they all tell the same story. It was peaceful, loving. They say this to a person. They say that they bonded in the isolation of that ranch. They rejected society's rules. There was no clocks, no books, no money, no structure. They scavenged for food from dumpsters. They grew vegetables. They smoked weed. They played music. They raised children. Even Manson remembered those days with affection.
And that was like the horses ruled the ranch. We all served whatever is capable of a service. A slave understands its master much more than the master understands.
Manson always talked in these riddles, but when the subject of the ranch came up, he was nostalgic. He was almost joyful, inasmuch as Manson ever was joyful. But the way he said it, you could hear the devotion in his voice, like he believed that was kind of a paradise. But this piece has a short half-life. On the ranch, isolation turns into something darker. When the world feels distant, it's easy to start seeing it as the enemy. That's how a commune turns into a cult. In fact, we know the night it begins. It all starts on July 1st, 1969. 50 years later, the details of that night are foggy, but here's what we know. Manson had a right-hand man named Charles Tex Watson.
Tex is perfect.
He was a small-town boy from Coatesville, Texas, 6'2", good-looking, athletic. He's the kind of guy that could walk into any room and belong. I wrote Tex Watson a number of letters and tried to engage with him. He wouldn't speak with me. But this is a 1984 parole hearing in which you can hear Tex speak, and I think it actually gives you a lot of insight into who he is.
In the lead role, I was the male at the crime. But at that time, I did not consider myself a leader. I considered myself more of a follower of Charles Manson in carrying out his orders. When I was 23 years old, I don't feel I had the leadership qualities to carry that out.
But by 1969, Tex is strung out on LSD, methadrine, speed, and cocaine. And on July 1st, he rips off a drug dealer named Bernard Crow for $2,500 worth of drugs. I asked Manson about this, and he says Tex promised to deal some dope, took the money, and ran. Pretty simple. That same night, Bernard Crow calls Spawn Ranch. He gets Manson on the phone, and he demands his money back. The moment the call ends, fear spreads through the ranch. They're convinced that whatever Tex has done is about to come crashing back on them. Now, I've tracked down many of the people who were there that night, and they all remember the same thing, just absolute panic. One of the women who was there was named Cappy. She was a teenager at the time. She's since passed away. But I spent hours talking to her on the phone, and this is how she described that exact night.
He was worried about us getting killed. We had babies there and all kinds of stuff, and all these, like, young people, okay? And they were trying to kill us.
One of the women told me, quote, "We were up all night. People thought the ranch was going to burn, that they were going to kill all the girls," end quote. Now, "they" means one thing to the Manson family on this night. It means the Black Panthers. Manson believed that the drug dealer, Bernard Crow, was a member of the Black Panther Party. In Los Angeles in 1968, the Panthers were one of the most militant organized forces of the Black Power movement, confronting police brutality and racism in a city ready to explode. Now, was Bernard Crowe really a Black Panther? There's no evidence I've ever seen to confirm that he actually was. But the key to remember here is that everyone at the ranch believed that he was. This is what they told me. And they began seeing the Black Panthers as the enemy. Now, a quick aside here. The prosecution will later paint this night and these events as driven by Manson's core ideological racism. And if the question is whether or not Manson was a racist, well, he absolutely was. I mean, he talked about race frequently. He'd grown up in the Ohio River Basin decades before civil rights. He'd spent most of his adult life segregated in prison. I mean, there's no question he was a racist. But it wasn't because he was a white supremacist or had some sort of underlying belief system that motivated this. This is just how he saw the world. So back to July 1st. Manson takes the phone call, the ranch is in a panic, and Manson makes the fateful decision to confront Bernard Crowe for himself. Manson and another man drive to Crowe's apartment in Hollywood, and when they arrive, Tex is long gone.
What happened was Tex made to deal with him, evidently, and then fucking bummed out on the deal. We didn't get anything out of it. It had nothing to do with us. It was all about Tex. Trust me.
The argument escalates, and Manson has brought this old 22 caliber revolver with him. It looks like a gun Yosemite Sam would carry around, a long-barreled revolver from an old Western or something.
Bernard Crowe didn't give him a chance. He had to shoot him, or he was going to get shot, and Bernard Crowe just said, you better shoot me now. Do it. You know, and so I shot him. But, you know,
the bullet rips through Crowe's stomach and lodges in his spine. Crowe collapses, and then he plays dead. And Manson panics, and he runs. He goes all the way back to the ranch. He's terrified. He's paranoid. He's convinced he's just murdered one of the Black Panthers. Now, the irony of this whole situation is that Crowe actually survives. But Manson won't know that for years. He actually won't know until Crowe walks into trial to testify. The paranoia in the group blooms, and they're all looking to Manson to save them. And in desperation, Manson brings in protection in the form of a biker gang from Venice Beach called the Straight Satans. I uncovered an LAPD interview from 1969 with the gang's former president, Al Springer, and he actually remembers the deal that Manson offered him. It was very simple, protection for favors.
He says, move up here, you can have all the girls you want, all the girls, he says, they're all yours.
So the Satans take the deal, and they move into Spawn Ranch. And the situation goes from bad to worse. Within a few weeks, another of Manson's people gets tangled up into a second drug deal. This time, it's 21-year-old Bobby Beausoleil.
You have a prepaid call from...
Bobby.
An inmate at the California Medical Facility.
I spoke to Bobby for years. In fact, Manson himself told me that Bobby was a key to understanding the story. To this day, Bobby is still incarcerated in California, despite being paroled twice. In 1969, he's a wannabe actor, wannabe musician, but everyone describes him the same. Charismatic, dark hair, dark eyes, ambitious. So as Bobby tells it, when Bernard Crowe is shot, he's not really paying attention to the ongoings of the Manson family. He's not even living on the ranch. But when the Straight Satans accept Charlie's offer, Bobby's drawn in. Bobby aspires to be a biker. He's fixing up a motorcycle in his garage. So he takes the opportunity to hang around the Satans. As Bobby tells it, the Straight Satans ask him to get them $1,000 worth of mescaline. Bobby wants to impress them, so he turns to an old friend, his ex-roommate, a guy named Gary Hinman. Gary's a musician, a college student, and a part-time drug dealer. Bobby gets the drugs from Gary, he hands them off, and the next day the Satans corner him. They're furious. And they claim the batch of mescaline was bad, and they demand their money back.
You know, they were blaming me for a sucker. It wasn't any, you know, bad drugs or anything like that. It was just, you know, I think they were trying to get the drugs for free.
But in 1969, he doesn't know that. He just wants to make things right.
I figured it was going to be no problem. Get the money back and, you know, and come back and give it to them, and it was going to be done.
So on Friday, July 25th, Bobby and two women head over to Gary Hinman's house. With him is Mary, the first member of the group and the mother of Manson's child, and another woman named Susan Atkins, who they call Sadie. At first, it's calm. Small talk, music, a few beers. And eventually, Bobby brings up the money. I tracked down an early statement that Mary gave to investigators in 1969, and she said, quote, "Bobby told Gary, we need the money. Gary said he didn't have any, then jabber jabber, and Bobby pulled out the gun being a 9mm that Bobby's brought with him, just in case." The scene devolves into chaos. Whatever the plan was that night, it's long gone now. Now it's a sudden, clumsy fight in the kitchen. Bobby and Gary are slamming into cabinets. They're each trying to get a hold of the gun. The weapon fires once, but the bullet buries itself in a cabinet. No one's hit. The fight starts again. Gary even makes it to the front door at one point, screaming for help, and the women tackle him to the ground and pull him back inside. And while all this is going on, at some point, one of the women calls Spahn Ranch, and they plead for Manson to come help them. But it takes Charlie a while to get there, and in that time, cooler heads prevail. Gary is persuaded to sign over two old cars he's got parked out front. Combined, they're worth maybe the $1,000 Bobby owes. The women pack up to leave. Bobby thinks it's over, and then there's a knock at the door. Charlie walks in, and he's furious. He's holding this vintage Confederate sword that he was known to carry around the ranch. Gary opens the door. He says, "Hi, Charlie," and without a word, Manson swings the sword. The blade slices across Gary's face. There's a 5-inch gash through his left cheek. It nearly severs his ear, nearly takes his ear right off. Manson stares at him for a moment, and then he just turns and leaves. And just like that, whatever humanity is left in this room is gone.
That was why I had killed him, because Charlie had slashed his face and left me with a problem, and I didn't know how to get out of it.
For the next 2 days, Bobby and the two women, they just stay with him. They try to figure out what to do. Gary keeps asking them to take him to the hospital, but that's not an option. The women try and sew his cheek shut with dental floss, but it makes everything worse. They take turns watching Gary, changing his bandages. They cook for him. Mary goes out for groceries at one point. It becomes a hostage situation that no one seems capable of ending. And by the second night, Bobby, sleep-deprived and unraveling, he decides there's only one way out.
I didn't know how to get away without getting arrested, unless I killed him.
It took me nearly a year of speaking to Bobby to get him to talk about this night. And he maintains that he doesn't actually remember killing Gary, just everything leading up to it. According to the medical examiner, the victim had 2 stab wounds to the chest, each about 1.5 inches long. Another wound ran from behind the left ear across the cheekbone, cutting the ear in half. No defensive wounds were found on the arms or hands. Afterwards, the women clean up. They gather every towel, every blanket, rag, anything that could tie them to the house. They wipe down the surfaces. They're careful. They pick up their garbage. But before they leave, Bobby writes, "Political Piggy" on the wall. Beside it, he draws a Black Panther paw print in blood. When I asked Bobby, he can't remember physically drawing on the walls in blood, but he does tell me that that is his intent. He's trying to frame the Black Panthers for the murder, the same Black Panthers that the Straight Satans are allegedly protecting the ranch against. After the murder, the women return to Spahn Ranch, and Bobby just takes off. About 10 days later, on Wednesday, August 6th, police find him about 175 miles from the ranch in a stolen white Fiat station wagon belonging to Gary Hinman. Bobby gives the police a lot of bad answers, and after they interrogate him for about 20 minutes, he's arrested for murder. The next day, Thursday, August 7th, Bobby is transferred back to Los Angeles. And on the morning of Friday, August 8th, he's arraigned, bail denied. Back at the ranch, paranoia is at an all-time high. Bobby's arrest spooks the Straight Satans and they take off. They go back to Venice Beach where their clubhouse is located. Manson is convinced that the commune is once again exposed, vulnerable to attack. And on top of that, if police can tie Bobby to the Gary Hinman murder, Manson believes it's only a matter of time before they uncover what happened to Bernard Crowe. In that fog of fear, isolation, and groupthink, a plan begins to take shape. They need to kill again. Something brutal enough to grab the cops' attention and make it look like the murderous Panthers are still out there. The logic is crude, but in Manson's mind, it's clear. If the police think the real killers are still active, they'll go easy on Bobby.
He was trying to send a message to me, you know, to make the police think they're the wrong person.
It's August 8th, 1969, and Tex takes three women and drives into the Hollywood Hills. All the women are dressed in black, barefoot, and have buck knives. First, there's Patricia Krenwinkel, called Katie. You'll remember she was the second of Manson's early followers. Susan Atkins, who they call Sadie, she's the one who participated in the Gary Hinman murder and known for being one of the most volatile members of the group. And finally, there's Linda Kasabian. I haven't even mentioned her name yet, and that's because she only joined the group a few weeks earlier. And in those weeks, she's become very close with Tex. She will go on to become the star witness for the prosecution against Manson. So Tex rides shotgun, and he directs Linda to an address on Cielo Drive. The house's previous tenant was Terry Melcher, a record producer who met the Manson family through Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. Melcher would later testify that he and Tex became close friends, and that he'd brought Tex to the property, quote, approximately six times. But on the night of August 8th, 1969, Terry Melcher is nowhere near Cielo Drive. He's been gone for almost 10 months. The house is now rented to film director Roman Polanski and his wife Sharon Tate. But that night, Polanski is overseas. He's prepping a movie in London. Sharon Tate, 8.5 months pregnant, is home with four friends and a groundskeeper who lives in the guest house tucked behind the main property. When they arrive, Tex and the women begin climbing a fence and begin walking up to the property. Moments later, they see headlights. Behind the wheel is their first victim, a 17-year-old kid named Stephen Parrott, who's just dropped by to sell the groundskeeper a clock radio. Wrong place, wrong time. Tex has the same .22-caliber revolver that Manson used just weeks earlier in the Bernard Crowe shooting, and he fires four times. Parrott dies instantly, and the group moves towards the main house. They break in by cutting a screen door of an open window. Tex climbs inside. He lets the others in through the front door. On the couch, they surround a man sleeping under a blanket. Wojciech Frykowski, a longtime friend of Roman Polanski and a house guest. Tex orders them to spread out, and within minutes, the four intruders have rounded up everybody in the house. Frykowski, his girlfriend, Abigail Folger, the same Folger who stands to inherit the Folger's coffee fortune, along with Sharon Tate and a celebrity hairstylist who's also her best friend, Jay Sebring. They're all herded into the living room, bound with towels and ropes. The Manson family is improvising at this point. It's the middle of the night. They don't recognize any of their prisoners. They don't watch movies. They have no idea who Sharon Tate is, despite the fact that she's incredibly famous at this point. They're all in various stages of methamphetamine highs, acid trips, or some combination of the two. The level of drugs the Manson family is on at this point is hard to imagine. By his own admission, Tex has been awake for nearly 30 days, riding a nonstop meth high. Katie and Sadie would later testify that they'd taken hundreds of acid trips leading up to the murders. Hundreds. They later say it took them years, years to come down. So they aren't prepared or even really processing what they're about to do. In a 1976 prison interview, Sadie remembers this moment.
I remember when we first went in, one of the people said, "Who are you?" And Tex said, "I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business."
So things are happening very quickly. They loop a noose over the ceiling beam for Sharon Tate. Tex orders them all to lie face down, and after that, it's just chaos. According to the autopsy, Sharon Tate suffered multiple stab wounds, most concentrated across the chest and back. The pattern and depth of the injuries pointed to a rapid and frenzied assault. She was 8 months pregnant. Jay Sebring, found close to her, had been shot once and stabbed multiple times. His injuries showed signs of blunt force trauma, consistent with a struggle. Outside the house, Abigail Folger's autopsy documented numerous stab wounds. Blood patterns and the location of her body indicated she had fled into the yard, collapsing only after a sustained attack. Nearby, Frykowski showed extensive blunt force trauma in addition to stab and gunshot wounds. The wounds suggested a prolonged fight. He resisted until he was overwhelmed. Together, the autopsy findings illustrated a chaotic and brutal sequence. Multiple attackers, extreme violence, and a level of frenzy that went far beyond a targeted killing.
I remember that I had absolutely, I felt nothing. I felt absolutely nothing for her. As she begged for her life and for the life of her baby.
Before leaving, Sadie dips a towel in blood and crouches by the front door. And for the second time, the family leaves a message written in blood. A single word, pig. A callback to the Gary Hinman murder. The message is clear. The Black Panthers, the ones the Manson family are trying to blame for all this chaos, they're still on the loose. By the time Tex, Sadie, Katie, and Linda make their way back to Spahn Ranch, it's early Saturday morning. A select few are told about what happened, and no doubt this includes Manson, though he'd never admit it. He never admitted it to me, and I've never read a credible source where he talked about knowing what happened that night, though rumors have persisted over the years, and people have told me confidentially that they believe Manson went back to the house that night, surveyed the carnage, and staged the crime scene. Though outside anecdotal evidence, I cannot prove that. In going through the LAPD archives, I found a 1969 interview between prosecutors and Leslie Van Houten, who was one of the Manson women. Leslie, like many of the other women, was a lost soul. Prior to meeting Manson, she had become pregnant as a teenager and had a black market abortion. She contemplated suicide, but found the women at Spahn Ranch instead. This is what she recalled from the night after the Sharon Tate home invasion.
The next day, I think the rest came back and they said that they had killed him.
Who said that?
Sadie came in grinning, saying we killed him. And then I asked her what it was like, you know, and she just said that it was real weird.
The following night, Sunday, August 10th, they go out again. This time they target a different house, a party house owned by a man named Harold True, which is on Waverly Drive. In the LAPD archives, I found an interview between prosecutors and Harold True, and Harold describes giving the Manson family a map to his house a year before the murders.
Now, how did he get your, have your phone number to call?
Well, I guess maybe I gave him a map.
We had
there was four of us. It was a party house. It was a big house and nice, and so we had these little maps printed up, and we'd say we're having a party here. So here it is.
This time, a different mix piles into the car. We have the Tate killers, Tex, Linda, Katie, and Sadie, joined this time by Charlie himself, another man who does little more than tag along, and Leslie Van Houten. When they get to Harold's house, they see that Harold's moved out about a year earlier, and Manson himself makes the decision to walk across the lawn to the home of Lino and Rosemary LaBianca. Manson has no connection to these people. He's never met them. Lino is a successful grocery store executive. He's a part-time owner of a supermarket chain called Gateway Markets. He's a big man, mid-40s, thick head of dark hair, businessman's confidence. Also a gambler, known to keep large sums of cash around the house. Rosemary is in her late 30s, elegant and warm, the co-owner of a small boutique in Hollywood. She'd been married before, had two children, both nearly grown, and together they lived a quiet life, loved to entertain. Manson enters the LaBianca house with Tex. They break in through a back door. They tie up the sleeping couple. They tell them not to panic. Manson tells them it's just a robbery and they should stay calm. And they return to the car in about 5 to 10 minutes.
I heard Charlie talking to Dick, and he said, I got everything okay. and they think it's a robbery. And just, they're tied up. Just go on in. I got their wallet. They're sure it's a robbery. Just tell them everything's okay so that when they...
Now, by all accounts, Manson drives away, leaving Tex, Katie, and Leslie Van Houten behind. Once inside, the scene begins to unfold, much like the night before. Leslie takes Rosemary into the bedroom, improvising restraints with a pillowcase and a lamp cord. Lino is later found the same way. His head is covered, a cord around his neck. The autopsy report tells us that Lino dies first, stabbed with his own kitchen knives while lying flat on his back, 26 stab wounds in total, 12 to the neck and torso, plus multiple additional puncture wounds to the abdomen. Rosemary fights back. Evidence suggests that she struggles violently. Defensive wounds on her hands and arms, bruising consistent with restraint around her neck from the lamp cord and pillowcase, 41 stab wounds in total, most concentrated on her back and lower torso.
I went back in the bedroom and I saw the woman laying down, and Tex handed me the knife and, you know, said, okay, you know, get to it.
Once the couple is dead, they continue with their pattern of leaving messages in the victim's blood. Words like rise and death to pigs appear in different rooms, matching the style and intent of the night before at Cielo Drive. On Lino LaBianca's body, the word war is carved into his abdomen. The cuts are deliberate and post-mortem, an act that investigators later describe as both symbolic and meant to mislead. These stage messages become the crucial link between the three crime scenes. It reinforces the idea that the same group is responsible for all of the murders, the Black Panthers. At the same time, Manson is in Venice Beach, heading straight towards the Straight Satan's Clubhouse at Pacific and 18th Avenue, a block from the Sand. Why? In all likelihood, Manson takes whatever money he's stolen from the LaBiancas, pays off the Satans, restores protection, thinks he's buying Bobby a little silence. On the morning of August 9th, the bodies of Sharon Tate, her three house guests, and Stephen Perrin are found strewn across the property on Cielo Drive. The resulting news coverage and investigation sends Los Angeles into a full-blown panic. The murder consumes the news cycle, gun sales spike, and celebrities go into hiding, believing that Sharon Tate has been murdered as part of a bizarre religious ritual targeting famous people. It sounds crazy now, but at the time, up until Manson was captured, that is what they believed. Frank Sinatra himself went into hiding. Meanwhile, the Manson family scatters from Spahn Ranch, though not before killing a ranch hand whom Manson thought was a police informant. That one was the most straightforward of the murders. They believe the man is a snitch. Nearly a decade later, in 1977, the body of Donald Shorty Shea is recovered in a shallow grave roughly 100 feet down an embankment below Spahn Ranch. The autopsy findings show the victim had been stabbed in the side before his body was placed into the grave. It's in fact the only one of the murders Manson directly participates in. They bury him, and his body's later recovered in the 1980s. Tex goes back to life as normal. Remember, this is the guy that led the murder parties, the guy that wielded the knife. He goes back to McKinney, Texas to visit his family. He goes on vacation in Mexico and Hawaii. Never mentions a word to anybody about his experiences with Manson or the group. Katie, who is an integral member of both the Tate and LaBianca murders, goes back to her childhood home in Mobile, Alabama. She takes a job, never says a word to anyone. Likewise, Linda Kasabian goes back to New Hampshire, and Leslie Van Houten goes back to living with her parents in Los Angeles. But Manson and Sadie, they get picked up by police for an unrelated vandalism charge in Death Valley, along with a bunch of members of the group. This is about 6 months after the murders, and by this time, police are nowhere near to solving the case. Manson isn't on their radar. He's not even close to their radar. In fact, the Gary Hinman murder even goes to trial.
Just a quiet little trial in Santa Monica. The jury was hung 8-4. So it was declared a mistrial because of that. Even, you know, and I didn't even testify because the case was really very weak.
There's no mention of Manson or the family or Sharon Tate, nothing. Bobby's thinking that Manson's plan has worked. And that's when Sadie randomly confesses. So Susan Atkins was housed in the same cell block as a call girl named Virginia Graham. And we were actually able to track her down, living in a retirement home in Phoenix, Arizona. She was incredibly gracious with her time, and we got her firsthand account of this moment.
She plopped herself down and she sat on the bunk and we started talking. And she presumed to tell me how stupid the police were and they were dumb. And I certainly do remember saying to her that she talked too much and she should keep her mouth shut. And she looked at me and she said to me, I don't worry about that. You have kind brown eyes and I know I can talk to you. Well, ever since then, I've often wondered about my kind brown eyes. But anyway, she said to me, you know those murders up Benedict Canyon? And for a moment I hesitated, but I did say Benedict Canyon, and she said, yes. And then I realized possibly what she was referring to. And she says, you know who did it, don't you? And I said, no. And she said, cold as can be, you're looking at her.
And that was it. Virginia tips off the police. Manson is already in prison. The others are arrested at their homes. And the trial of the century ensues, prosecutors never once coming close to putting it all together. Instead, the trial is dominated by headlines about the Beatles' White Album and how Manson aspired to be a rock star and has magical powers. I have boxes and boxes and boxes of the trial transcripts at home, and they're a crazy read. In fact, I have a great quote here from the closing arguments. Quote, the family was nothing more than a closely knit band of vagabond robots who were slavishly obedient to one man and one man only, their master, their leader, their god, Charles Manson. Within his domain, his authority and power were unlimited. He was the doctrinal Maharaja, if you will, of a tribe of boot-licking slaves who were only happy to do his bidding for him. This is how they spoke about Manson at the trial. At the same time, Manson and his followers act outrageously during the trial. They hold vigils, they shave their heads, they're singing and chanting, giving bizarre interviews to anyone who'll stick a camera in their face. But that's how a man gets turned into a monster.
You tell me that the media don't have no power because you don't know the media. The media has the power of the press. The power of the press is the power.
In reality, when I met Manson, I realized he was little more than a clever convict, someone who'd learned to survive by reading people, by manipulating his surroundings, by reflecting back to people what they brought to him.
All I'm looking for is to help me. I've always been by myself, alone. That's why nobody testified against me. Because I've always been alone.
He wasn't a prophet or a puppet master. He was a man shaped by a brutal upbringing, well-suited to a chaotic moment in American history. And through a series of events, he was recast as the character of evil, the devil incarnate. And as his legend grew, Manson became kind of a cultural icon, an idol for white, disaffected men. The swastika he carved in his forehead wasn't very subtle. It was a symbol that said, I'll be whoever you want me to be.
Everybody will tell you what they think about me according to what they want to use me for.
A killer hippie, the anti-establishment outlaw. Most of it wasn't true, but it didn't matter to Manson. He was willing to wear any mask, adopt any myth, as long as it made him larger than life. To him, the only truth that mattered was his own reflection. If the world saw him as a cult leader, a monster, a god, well, that was their trip, not his.
Have a good day, brother.
If you go to our social media channels, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram, you'll see additional content about this episode, more phone calls, insights, interviews, and we'll be posting incredible things daily from the last decade of true crime reporting. This season on Unmarked, you'll hear exclusive audio of interviews, calls, and content, including the last interview Robert Picton ever gave before he died. This episode of Unmarked is produced by John Nadeau, edited by Dave Alderson, and our producers are Jesse Demaray and Steve McClellan. I'm James Buddy Day.